Here's another little bit from that book. Art cinemas. They might show far more subtitled movies than are good for them, but any cinema that serves a cup of tea and a slice of cake that you can take into the auditorium with you is worthy of celebration. Watching angst-ridden French actors argue with each other in between bouts of athletic and graphic sex is made all the more palatable with a forkful of cream slice. Try it sometime. It's actually the cup of tea, I think. That's it. Sir David Attenborough. Sir David Attenborough is worthy of two entries in this book. One for his remarkable body of work and another for the wonderfully soothing effect of his voice. But I shall combine both here. He has been broadcasting on television since 1954, and his career since then has spanned 20 separate series, with the 21st currently in production. Actually, I think it's more since this book was made, but anyway. Countless individual documentaries, his perceptive, empathetic, and enthralling commentary to each of these programmes has been one of the major factors in their enduring quality, and generations of children and adults have grown up listening to his voice. He has informed, educated, and delighted an entire nation. A fascinating fact. Attenborough's groundbreaking 1979 series, Life on Earth, was watched by over 500 million people worldwide when it was originally broadcast. B now. Bacon sandwiches. Oh gosh. Proof of the irresistible nature of the bacon sandwich is that it stands as the number one reason for former vegetarians falling off the wagon. Even hardened veggies, you know, the ones who don't even eat fish, can be seen to swoon at the smell of frying bacon and the sight of a bread knife cutting through a crusty loaf in preparation. I once lived with a woman who had been vegetarian all her life. I blame the parents, but still insisted on making my bacon sandwich for me so that she could be close to the sheer culinary perfection. Bacon sandwiches come in all shapes and sizes, with many accompanying ingredients. But, and here is the ultimate accolade, they are all great. A long, crunchy baguette filled with exotic salad and slaverings of mayonnaise can be delightful. But then no connoisseur of the bacon butty would turn down two slices of white with a bit of butter and brown sauce either. It doesn't matter how you serve it up. A bacon sandwich is bloody marvellous. He everyone who makes a bacon sandwich will claim to be the finest proponent of the art in the whole of Christendom, and I'm no exception. So here is my classic recipe. 3 rashers of smoked back bacon. It's worth stumping up for some really good quality stuff from a proper butcher, but let's face it, anything will do. 2 slices of hand-cut crusty white bread. Some rocket leaves. A handful of cherry tomatoes cut in half. Parmesan cheese. Mayonnaise. Dijon mustard. And some butter, obviously. Fry the bacon in a little olive oil. While the bacon is almost cooked, but not quite at the crispy stage, chuck in some cherry tomatoes. While these are cooking, you can prepare the bread. Cut 2 thick slices and slap on the butter. Coat 1 slice with a generous amount of mayonnaise and the other with an equally friendly spreading of mustard. Using the mayo slices, your base, pile on the rocket leaves, as much as you want really. Once the bacon is crispy in a few, then arrange the slices on the bread. I prefer 2 diagonal and 1 across the middle. Plonk the cooked tomatoes on top and then, using a potato peeler, shave some parmesan over the whole lot. It will start to melt. Stick the mustard slice on top and press down firmly. Cut lengthways, never diagonally because it's too flimsy, and enjoy with a cup of tea, a broad grin, and juices dribbling down your chin. Another B. Bank holidays. Any day when you don't have to go into work is good. But here's the remarkable thing about bank holidays. There's no legal right to time off. But we get to stay at home anyway. Originally, in the 18th and 19th centuries, bank holidays were just that, days when the banks were closed. There were 30 to 40 of them spread across the year, coinciding with religious festivals and feast days, but only bank employees really benefited from them. It wasn't until 1871 where Sir John Lubbock introduced the Bank Holidays Act, and the rest of us got a lie-in as well. Lubbock was a wonderful old duffer who felt that a bank employee should be allowed to watch lots of cricket. So his list of holidays included the dates when the village matches tended to be played. There has been plenty of fiddling with the numbers, frequency and times of the bank holidays since the original Act of Parliament, and many people are lobbying for a few more days to be chucked in the mix as well. Most popular are the arguments for St George's Day, St Andrew's Day and St David's Days for England, Scotland and Wales respectively. In line with the National Day of Drinking and Falling Over, in Ireland they also asked for St Patrick's Day. Fascinating fact. Christmas Day and Good Friday are not technically bank holidays, although they are observed as common law holidays. So now you know. Ooh. Albert Barnes, Barnes. Every now and again, history throws up an individual so eccentric and remarkable that they deserve to become part of modern folklore. Albert Coombs Barnes is one such person. But sadly, his renown is nowhere near as great as it should be. Barnes was born in 1872 in Philadelphia in America, the son of a butcher. He paid his own way through university where he excelled in chemistry. As a young man, he developed a treatment for gonorrhea. Rumour had it to cure his own. That proved so successful that he was able to retire a millionaire at the age of 35. He subsequently founded the Barnes Foundation, which acted as an art collection and cultural centre. He also funded projects for the underprivileged of his home city, and he certainly knew his art from his elbow, since the foundation included works by Picasso, Mondigliani, Matisse, and a number of Renoirs, many of which he had bought for bargain prices. Access to this formidable art collection could only be achieved by writing to Barnes to request permission. Applicants who had, for whatever reason, incurred the ear of the great man would often receive rejection letters from Barnes's dog, Fidele. Here is one such letter. "Madam, I have received your letter of the something asking for leave to visit my master's foundation. Unhappily, being young and poor, my master was treated in a hospital founded by your family as a result of intimate relations with one of the nurses. He contracted a venereal disease. He has never forgotten this and is therefore obliged to refuse your request." He was also a strong supporter of the Black Rights Movement in America and would frequently receive visitors of all colours at his home in Philadelphia, where this brought protests from his neighbours. This was 1930s America. He pointed out that he owned the land and they lived, owned the land they lived on, and threatened to build a hospital for the black community right in the middle of the richest district in town, and they soon shut up. My favourite Barnes story was that when a rich socialite couple came to visit the foundation, they were met by a janitor who was busy washing the floors. They then proceeded to loudly criticise the Renoirs and Cezannes on display, at which point the janitor manhandled them off the premises. He, of course, turned out to be Barnes himself. Baths. With any combination of the following. Baths with a glass of wine, bubble baths, baths with a good book, and baths with someone else. Another B. Bedtime stories. When I was a child, I would look forward to bedtime and hearing the magical stories my parents would read from books or make up off the top of their heads. It was one of the highlights of my day. Now, as a parent, I find myself looking forward to my children's bedtime so that I can read them stories or make some up myself. It's absolutely the highlight of my day.